From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the life and teachings of Buddha. We talk with religion scholar Karen Armstrong about the North Indian man from a wealthy family who left his wife and son to find enlightenment. Later, he taught his disciples to look for the truth within themselves. The Buddha is the subject of Armstrong's new book. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews Demons and Angels, the new 3-CD set of the music of blues guitarist, the blind Reverend Gary Davis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton and Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton say they didn't know that Mrs. Clinton's brother was paid for successfully lobbying for a pardon and a prison commutation that Clinton granted on his final day in office. Hugh Rodham reportedly got about $200,000 in pay and a contingency fee. The Clintons said they were deeply dismayed to learn of the arrangement and had asked Rodham to return the money. Hugh Rodham reportedly gave the money back in the past 24 hours. Rodham was paid for his work to commute the drug sentence of Carlos Vignali, the son of a wealthy political contributor. He reportedly got a contingency fee for helping with the pardon of Glenn Braswell, who's currently under investigation in a tax evasion and money laundering case. Major record labels have begun to respond to an offer by the Napster Internet Music Service to settle a lawsuit against it. NPR's Rick Carr reports.
Napster is offering record labels $1 billion over 5 years for permission to use their music and settle the copyright infringement lawsuit they filed in 1999. Major record labels have reacted coolly to the proposal. In a statement, Sony Music Entertainment said Napster's offer represents only a tiny part of the revenues that it alleges are threatened by the online copying of music. The world's largest record label, the Universal Music Group, dismissed the Napster proposal in a statement. Universal said the plan doesn't do enough to protect copyrights. An executive of EMI Recorded Music says Napster hasn't formally approached his label with details of the proposal. For its part, the internet firm contends it's been making this offer to major labels for months. Rick Carr, NPR News, New York.
A report on physician-assisted suicide in Oregon shows the same number of terminally ill people died with a doctor's prescription in 2000 as did in 1999. Colin Fogarty reports from Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Since Oregon became the only state in the nation to allow physician-assisted suicide for dying patients, state regulators have published an annual report on the policy. It shows last year 27 Oregonians took lethal drugs prescribed by a doctor, the same as the previous year. Health officials say that's a minuscule number compared to the 30,000 deaths in Oregon every year. There were no major complications, but one patient regurgitated a small amount of lethal drugs before slipping into a coma and dying within 7 minutes. The health division reported one physician to the Board of Medical Examiners for failing to fill out paperwork correctly. The report is published in this week's New England Journal of Medicine. For NPR News, I'm Colin Fogarty in Portland, Oregon.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 204 points, or 1.9%. It closed at 10,527 in active trading of more than a billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 49 points, or more than 2%. This is NPR News. Scientists studying a 150-million-year-old dinosaur skull say they've discovered an unusual form of predatory behavior. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
Among the fiercest dinosaurs of the Jurassic period was the Allosaurus, a 1.5-ton meat-eater similar to Tyrannosaurus rex. Scientists at Cambridge University in England recently took sophisticated X-ray scans of the animal's yard-long skull. They then used computers and engineering programs to create a digital version. In recreating the kind of muscles and stress the skull and jaws would experience, the scientists concluded that the animal had a surprisingly weak bite, about like a modern-day panther. They concluded that the Allosaurus used its head like a hatchet. It would bludgeon its prey and tear out hunks of flesh in a single motion. Writing in the journal Nature, the scientists say the use of engineering analysis helps them understand how different body shapes evolved over time. Christopher Joyce, NPR News, Washington.
Federal prosecutors in Tampa, Florida, are seeking to dismiss charges against a couple accused of lying about the disappearance of their baby daughter. Marlene and Steve Eisenberg said their 5-month-old daughter, Sabrina, disappeared from their home in 1997. They said the child was stolen by an intruder. Detectives used a listening device to tape conversations in the Eisenbergs' home. Prosecutors said the tapes captured incriminating remarks from the couple suggesting that they were covering up their daughter's death. Last week, a magistrate recommended that the tapes not be allowed in court because they were nearly impossible to understand. Prosecutors said there's no longer a reasonable probability that the Eisenbergs would be convicted. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, saluting cultural programming on NPR, recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal of Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Most people think of Buddha as an icon, an archetypal religious symbol of enlightenment, not a man of flesh and blood. In her new book, Buddha, religion historian Karen Armstrong gives a name and a family and a context to the man that gave rise to Buddhism. Karen Armstrong's books include The Battle for God, A History of God, and Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths. She's a former Roman Catholic nun who teaches at Leo Beck College for the study of Judaism. Terry spoke with Karen Armstrong recently about her new book.
You say in your book that some Buddhists might say that to write a biography of the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, is a very un-Buddhist thing to do. Why would that be un-Buddhist?
Well, all his life, the Buddha was appalled at the idea of personality cults. He thought that by depending too much upon an authority figure, however august or splendid that figure might be, you were going to impede your spiritual development, keep yourself in an unworthy state of infantile dependence. And he always said that his life was not important, his experience was not important. What was important was his teaching, which he called his Dhamma, his teaching, which he guaranteed, if pursued by a serious seeker, would bring human beings to a sort of supernatural, sacred peace.
Now, you say that a lot of Buddhists would say it's kind of pointless to write a biography of the Buddha because it's not about his life, it's about his teachings. So why did you want to write a biography of Buddha?
Well, first of all, I think he's wonderful. I've always thought he's wonderful. And I think we've got a huge amount to learn from him. But it's not quite true what I said about the Buddhists being unconcerned about the Buddha's spiritual journey, his story, because he always claimed that his was an autobiographical philosophy. He always told his disciples that he would never ask them to do anything that he hadn't done himself. And so there are some aspects of the Buddha's life that have always been very important to Buddhists, and those I've emphasized in my own little biography. Those moments are when he left home and decided to pursue the spiritual life and gave up worldly life. His long struggle to find enlightenment, going from one teacher to another until he decided he would depend upon himself. Then the process of enlightenment, when he actually experienced a reality that he called nirvana and became a Buddha, a man who had woken up to the full potential of humanity, and his decision to teach. That was always very important to the Buddha. And finally, his death. But the people of India, when they spoke about the Buddha's life, were concerned not with writing the sort of biography that we write today, where we try to find out exactly what happened when. They were interested always in the meaning of this life, and they told the Buddha's life story to help other people, help other Buddhists gain their own enlightenment. By watching the way the Buddha had done it, you would learn how you yourself could become enlightened too.
Oh, here's a stupid question. Was there anything resembling Buddhism before the Buddha?
There were a number of developments in India that the Buddha used, certainly. And he himself always claimed, like any sage of antiquity, that his teaching was not original. It's only in our own day that we put such great importance on being absolutely original. He said that in the very earliest days, human beings had known that this was the best way to live. He had rediscovered what he called an ancient path.
Do all the different sects of Buddhism generally agree that Siddhartha Gautama was the founder of Buddhism, or is there some controversy over that?
No, I think all of them revere the Buddha and see him as crucial. But it's a bit different from the way we are in, say, Christianity. If it was discovered that, for example, the Buddha had never existed, it wouldn't make much difference to the Buddhist religion, because the important thing is the method and not the personality. And the method has been found to work. Whereas if Christians found that Jesus hadn't existed, that really would be trouble. So we must see him in that way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is religion scholar Karen Armstrong, and her new book is called Buddha, and it's a biography of the Buddha. What kind of family was the Buddha born into?
Well, again, we don't quite know that for certain. But he must have belonged to one of the upper echelons of society. He had a comfortable home. He had cousins. He had a wife. And when he left home at 29, his wife had just given birth to a little boy. And so he left his wife and his son. He left his mother and father, who were getting on in years, to embark on the holy life.
Now, that's a very extreme thing to do at the age of 29, to leave your wife and newborn son and hit the road to try to have a more spiritual life. What kind of problem was he having with domestic life?
Well, he said that when he looked around his father's home, it felt sort of cramped and crowded and dusty, he said. It seemed to be filled with things that pulled at his heart, that made him cling to the things of this world. And he, like many, many other people in India at this time, were beginning to feel that this world was something that had to be transcended. People were feeling a great despair, a spiritual vacuum. And all over North India, around the Ganges Plain, young men and even a few women were leaving their families in this way and adopting a lifestyle that they called homelessness, going without the ordinary comforts, going and trying to get beyond desire, beyond the egotism of desire, which they said held them back from their potential.
Where did they go? I mean, they didn't hitchhike to California or go to India. They were already there. Where did they go?
Well, they generally took to the road. They took refuge in the forests. The forests of wonderful big trees around the Ganges Plain that were still not being cleared. But they also, and the Buddha himself, spent a lot of time not in remote hermitages or shrines, but in the great new thriving industrial towns. India was undergoing a huge economic revolution. This was what had caused the spiritual crisis, because the old ideas no longer worked in this rather aggressive mercantile economy. And there were big new kingdoms coming up. And the Buddha spent most of his life in the new developing cities because he wanted to bring his message to suffering humanity. And it was in the cities where people were feeling most dislocated and lost.
Now, some people might find it a pretty unacceptable thought that you would leave your family and a newborn child to seek a spiritual life. Mm. But you point out that Jesus said something very comparable to that. What was it?
Well, Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, you must leave your wife and your family, leave the dead to bury their dead, leave your old people, and come and follow me. And this was a characteristic of spiritual leaders at this time. It was a very momentous time in the religious history of humanity. Socrates had very little time for women or family life, neither did Confucius, both of whom were sort of related in time to the Buddha. And so I myself, of course, as at the age of 17, heard this call of Jesus, as I thought, and went off, left my family, and went embraced celibacy and became a Catholic nun. So that call to single-heartedness was very typical of the time, particularly in India, and the people respected it. People of India can be as materialistic as anybody else, but they have a great respect for those who do seek the spiritual life. And they didn't see these people as irresponsible dropouts. They saw them as pioneers who were bravely and often at great cost to themselves trying to find a spiritual solution for people who were beginning to succumb to a kind of despair, to sorrow, and a feeling that they were trapped in an unacceptable spiritual situation.
Karen Armstrong has written a new biography called Buddha. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Karen Armstrong is my guest, and her books include the best-selling A History of God. Her new book is a biography of Buddha called Buddha. Where did the Buddha go when he left home at the age of 29?
Well, first he set out and went to the new kingdom of Rajagaha, but then he took to the roads. The Ganges Plain was undergoing a political revolution as well as a social and economic one, and two great kingdoms had appeared, which were swallowing up the smaller and more ineffective kingdoms. It was a very aggressive world. These kings had big armies. They were able to exercise great control over their population and be more efficient, therefore. But as a result, people in India were very worried about the new ruthlessness, and all of them were trying to find a new way of living that was modern, but which also sort of tried to not to harm people, not to trample on people, as seemed to be happening. So the Buddha went straight into these new developing kingdoms, Magadha and Kosala. He went to the to the cities, and there he went, and there he eventually found himself a teacher. He found himself a teacher who began to introduce him to the principles of spirituality.
What kind of teacher was this?
His name was Alara Kalama, and he taught a bit out of the way, out of the mainstream kingdoms. He taught a philosophy called Samkhya, as far as we know, which we don't need to go into now. But mostly what he taught yoga. And so he inducted Gotama into the practices of yoga, which is very different from the kind of yoga we practice today in our gyms or in the West.
What was it like then?
It was a very, it was an assault on egotism, an assault on the self. It was designed ruthlessly to take the I out, the me out of our thinking. Before you began to meditate, you had to undergo a lengthy series of mental, physical and moral disciplines, learning, as I say, not to live so aggressively. When you'd finally mastered this morality and this self-control and a degree of serenity, then you could start. You had to sit in an absolute stillness. Now, we human beings don't, we're not, are very rarely still. We're always shifting about, even in sleep. But the yogin sits absolutely motionless, so he looks more like a statue or a plant. Then next, he refuses to breathe. Breathing is the most basic of our animal-human functions. But the yoga practices a special kind of breathing, which has all kinds of physiological as well effects on the personality and induces a sense of calm, practitioners have found. And finally, you begin these extremely difficult exercises of concentration, which enable you not to look at objects through a sort of veil of subjectivity. How do these things affect me? Do I like them? Do they make me feel secure? But to see things as they are. And then you were beginning to be ready. If you were very, very skilled, because this was hard, you were beginning to be ready for the higher states, which some teachers thought would bring you to enlightenment and nirvana.
But practicing this extreme form of yoga didn't bring the Buddha to enlightenment.
He was always very happy with yoga, and yoga would play a crucial part in Buddhism. But he found that he couldn't accept Alara Kalama, his teacher's interpretation of the yogic experience. Alara Kalama said that when you had entered the higher reaches of yoga, the higher stages of trance, you had encountered what the people of North India called yourself with a capital S. That this was a transcendent part of yourself that was at one with the ultimate principle of the universe. We would say God. You were finding the divine within yourself. It was absolute reality. Now, Gotama said, yes, I've attained these higher states, but I can't believe that I've found this self. This is not absolute. I've engineered this experience for myself by means of my own expertise as a yogin. You can't manipulate the divine like that. Secondly, he said, this is only temporary. When I come back to myself after my trance, I'm still the same old person that I was before. I'm still full of lust. I'm still full of mean, spiteful thoughts. I'm still full of desire. I haven't changed. This isn't nirvana. So he left Alara Kalama, and this was one of the great things that characterized Gotama, was his energy. And he would never accept anybody else's word for it. He would have been horrified by the idea that we should take things on faith or accept the authority of an older, wiser person. You must make these doctrines work for you or they won't work at all, he said.
What was his concept of nirvana, of enlightenment, and when did he actually formulate his concept of it?
Well, there were lots of theories about what was this ultimate reality that everyone was seeking. Nirvana really is very similar to what monotheists call God. Except that monotheists, Jews, Christian, Muslims have personalized this and think of God as a personality. The Buddhists don't do this. The people of India in general don't do this. Nirvana is a state which you find within yourself of absolute peace. It's beyond the reach of selflessness. It's transcendent because it goes beyond the self. It's a state that we can't imagine, those of us who are unenlightened, because our lives are conditioned by selfishness, by sorrow, by pain. The peace that you would find in nirvana, what monotheists would say, was introducing you to the presence of God, and that it enabled you to suffer, but to live in peace in the midst of suffering. The Buddha never claimed that he was immune to suffering, but that he did claim that he could live with it in peace, and that he had attained a peace that was completely natural to human beings. He never claimed that this was supernatural in the way that we monotheists think of God as above nature. This was what anyone can do. A god hadn't given it to him. A human being could do it himself. This was a human being's full potential. You'd come across it by yoga in large part, and you would find this peace and enhancement of your being, rather as we watch, say, a ballet dancer or an athlete doing impossible things with his or her body. Because of this extreme skill and training, Buddhists were learning to do equally difficult things with their mind, train their minds to gain this fuller potential, which they said was how a human being should really be if he was using up all his resources.
How would you compare the concept of nirvana or enlightenment with the concept of heaven in Christianity?
Well, heaven in Christianity is a sort of place, as it were, that to which people repair after death. And we've often thought about it in rather naturalistic terms. Of course, when you think about heaven in a more serious theological way, you're introduced into the presence of God, and nobody knows what this could possibly be like. Now, that position is nearer to nirvana. Buddha always refused to define nirvana, just as the best Jews, Christians and Muslims have refused to define God, because our normal words and concepts and ideas just can't bear any relation to this absolute reality. It has to be experienced, sensed within yourself, and it can't be described to people who haven't been through the Buddhist regimen. And monotheists, the best Jewish, Christian, and Muslim theologians, have said the same about God: that you can't define God, that God and heaven, the ultimate salvation, lies beyond what anything that we can know. Some people think that Buddhists went into sort of extinction after death. But that's not true. They said that there was some form of existence, but you couldn't define it, you couldn't talk about it. It was beyond the reach of words, so you'd better not talk about it. It was just not useful. It was what the Buddha would say was inappropriate. It was an inappropriate question to ask, what is nirvana?
Do you know what some of the desires were that the Buddha wanted to transcend? What were some of the temptations that he struggled with?
Well, the concept of desire, we sometimes feel a bit daunted when we say we've got to get rid of desires, because our desires can be wonderful things. I mean, the desire for spirituality, the desire for art or beauty. But the Buddha was saying all these desires, those desires which make us say, I want, that make us look at things and see things only from our own point of view. That greed in us, he often called desire greed, or craving, that makes us yearn for something else.
Karen Armstrong speaking with Terry Gross. Armstrong's new book is Buddha. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a new set of recordings by the blues guitarist Reverend Gary Davis. Also, Reaching Enlightenment, we continue our conversation with religion scholar Karen Armstrong about the pivotal moment in Buddha's life. He's the subject of Armstrong's new biography. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Let's return to Terry's interview with religion scholar Karen Armstrong. Her new book, Buddha, is a biography of Siddhartha Gautama, the man who attained nirvana. Gautama was born to a wealthy family in northern India, centuries before the birth of Christ. He left his wife and infant son to seek spiritual enlightenment. Armstrong's other books include The Battle for God, A History of God, and Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths.
Now, you said that the Buddha was convinced that his childhood experience of pure joy offered a key to nirvana. What did he think that key was? Why did he look back on his childhood like that?
Well, he had a sort of Proustian memory. He just felt he'd come to the end of the road. He'd left Alara Kalama's sect. He tried another teacher, and that didn't work. He could not accept any of these teachers' interpretation of his religious experience. And he suddenly called to himself, there must be another way to enlightenment than this. Henceforth, he'd rely on himself. And then out of the blue, he remembered an experience he'd had when he was a very little boy. His father had taken him to see the ceremonial ploughing of the first field at spring in the springtime, and had joined in the ploughing and left the little Siddhartha under a tree. And there are several versions of this story, but one of them says that the little boy looked at the grass that had been cut in the course of the ploughing and noticed that these young shoots of young grass had been cut down and that there were little insects and eggs in this that were now all dying. And he felt a pang of pure disinterested grief and compassion for them. And compassion is something we haven't talked about yet, which is very important in Buddhism. But despite this pure sorrow, it was a beautiful day. And the Buddha suddenly composed himself. He was a natural little yogin, the story goes. And he composed himself in the position of a yoga and fell from a state of joy. He was just happy and contented, and he fell into a trance. Now, later, just as he'd uttered this despairing cry, there must be another way to enlightenment, he heard, he remembered this experience. Ever since he'd left his father's house 6 years before, he'd practiced fearful penances. He'd fought against all his desires. He'd fought against his human nature. But, he said, that was a very natural thing. It was a very human thing to do. I was a little boy. I didn't know anything about yoga, but I naturally did it. Perhaps nirvana is something much more natural to us. And perhaps instead of fighting our human nature, we can actually cultivate some of these experiences, like that disinterested joy, like that compassion for other beings. And perhaps that will bring us to enlightenment. And that was his program henceforth. Henceforth, he wouldn't subject himself, he said, to any more miserable penances. Joy could bring you to nirvana too, as long as your joy wasn't selfish and greedy. And compassion would bring you to nirvana, the disinterested sympathy and empathy for all other beings, which makes you push your own ego out of the way and place other beings in the center of your universe.
Is there a story of how the Buddha finally gained enlightenment?
Yes, there are several stories. In the Pali scriptures, which are the most authoritative scriptures, the account of the Buddha's enlightenment is really rather technical. If you're not a practiced yogin, it's rather baffling to read. But there are other stories which dwell on the more mythical elements of the story to show what was going on spiritually. It's said that the Buddha decided that he was now or never going to make the last go for enlightenment. So he went and sat one night under a Bodhi tree, one of the trees of India, and there he practiced his yogic exercises and fell into a trance. And there he had that night an insight that changed him forever and which made him convinced that he had found the way to enable human beings to live at peace amidst all the sufferings of this world, that he was now a man who'd woken up to his full potential. He was a Buddha. And that was the moment of his enlightenment. But it's very difficult to say what this insight was, because, of course, it's not really conceptually possible to define it, though he did have a shot at it when he tried to teach his message.
How did his life change after he reached enlightenment? How did he spend his time differently? How did he teach differently?
Well, his first instinct was he felt at peace. He felt liberated. He felt utterly joyful. But he just wanted to sit and enjoy that at first. And when he thought that he might, perhaps he ought to go and teach, he felt he didn't want to do that. He said, you know, no one's going to understand this. It'll be tiresome, disappointing, troublesome. People won't want to give up themselves. It'll be pointless. And then there's a really beautiful story. We are told that the god Brahma, in the highest heaven of all, was utterly dismayed when he heard this, because in the Buddhist ideology, gods need to be taught by the Buddha just as much as human beings how to attain this final peace. And he came down from his highest heaven, and reversing the normal roles of God and man, he knelt before the enlightened man and prayed to him and said, Lord, please look at the world, look at this suffering world in drowning in suffering, sorrow and pain, and bring relief. If you don't do that, the world is lost. The world is utterly lost. And then we're told that the Buddha surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha and felt compassion. And that's crucial, because a Buddha must feel compassion. And he saw that compassion had been such an essential part in his journey towards enlightenment. The whole dynamic of the experience he'd had impelled him towards back into the world, back into the marketplace, to bring relief to suffering human beings. That in henceforth, he always insisted, enlightenment and was not something you hugged selfishly to yourself. To live morally was to live for others. And so for the next 45 years, until he was 80 years old, he tramped through the roads of India, often sleeping rough, teaching everybody he met, men, women, merchants, kings, poor people, everybody, to bring them enlightenment. And he made a lot of converts.
Karen Armstrong, her new book is a biography of the Buddha. We'll hear more in a bit. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview Terry Gross recorded with religion scholar Karen Armstrong. Her new book is Buddha.
How did the Buddha die?
Well, when he was 80 years old, his health began to fail. 80 years old was quite an age for somebody in India at that time. But the account of his death is sorrowful. He was not sorrowful. He was full of peace and acceptance and thinking only of others, as usual. But it was a lonely death. He'd lived all his life surrounded by huge crowds of people. He was the friend of kings, of noblemen, merchants, powerful people loved to come and see him. But his death was lonely and solitary. It seems as though he and his faithful companion, Ananda, his cousin, who was his companion and personal attendant for 20 years, seemed to head off the map, away from the big powerful cities, into the jungle. There was nobody, no other senior member of the order present. The last years of the Buddha's life stress the aggression of and sorrow of society, of the society that he was trying in his own way to reform. So you have a sense of the great frailty and loneliness of old age as the Buddha and Ananda head off, two old men with some young monks, into the jungle. And there he's ill for some time, but then he's given a dish of some kind of food. We're not quite sure what it is, but he has a terrible bout of food poisoning. And he dies. But with great peace, affirming to his companions that this is not the end, and the fact that he is leaving them is just not important, because each of them must rely on themselves and not on him. And finally, his last words to them were, all things pass away, myself included. Seek your salvation with diligence. And then he fell into a coma and died.
Why was he in the jungle?
We don't know. It's as though there'd been a lot of violence in his life recently. One of his greatest friends was a king who had died a horrible death, been killed by his own son. Another king had also been savagely put down by his own retainers. The kingdoms were beginning even more violence as they extended their territories. And the last thing the Buddha heard was that one of these kingdoms was about to invade a small neighbouring republic. And it's as though he almost recoiled from this violence and went off out into the jungle, as though he's now saying, now I am leaving the world behind. And going off on my own. His disciples were worried about this, and you know, at the end, his beloved attendant Ananda said, "Lord, don't die in this miserable jungle backwater, this one-horse town. You know, go to one of the great cities." But a Buddha was not concerned with those kind of trappings of prestige, and a Buddhist can never be content with what he has already achieved. He must always be going on to something greater, go on into the unknown.
Now, there is Buddhist iconography. I mean, everyone's familiar with the sculpture of the pot-bellied Buddha. What is the place of that iconography within Buddhism, and what is specifically the place of that type of sculpture?
Well, at first, there was very little iconography of the Buddha, because it was felt that the Buddha had gone, as it were. You know, he was now in a completely different state. So to imagine him as a human being, an ordinary human being, or depict him as a human being, was really rather retrograde. It was clinging to something that had passed and was over. But by about the first century, you have these images of the Buddha in contemplation. The Buddha in as an enlightened being, and each person depicts him in their own cultural idiom. So I think the pot-bellied Buddhism is a Chinese ideal. There are much more sort of graceful, shapely Buddhas in India. The idea is to be an inspiration by looking at that man, lost in contemplation, serene. You are learning what all human beings are capable of. We can all be like the Buddha. We're not meant to sort of bow down and worship him, but it's meant to be an incentive to act.
You say in your biography of the Buddha that you think Buddhism fits a modern sensibility. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are all kinds of aspects of Buddhism which are appealing to the modern world. First of all, it's very, very practical. The Buddha had no time, as I've said, for rigid doctrines. Even his own teachings, he said, you must be sceptical about them, you must test them out and see if they work. He had no time for abstruse metaphysics, abstruse theology. He said, these things won't help you. What he was doing was giving you a program. So that practical, empirical, if you like, tenor to Buddhism is attractive. Similarly, the stress on self-reliance, the refusal to revere authority figures, the refusal to take things on faith or take things on second hand, but to make sure that you yourself can affirm a teaching with not just taking somebody else's word for it. That, again, is very, very, I think, congenial to us in our modern society, where we place great stress on self-reliance and human dignity and on freedom from subservience. I think, too, the stress on compassion All the great world religions teach that compassion is the most important of all the religious virtues, but we keep losing sight of this and stressing other less, more peripheral concerns. And that, I think, is hugely important to us. And people who are recoiling from the intolerance and unkindness of much institutional religion will find the Buddha's compassion and tolerance, I think, very attractive and appealing. So, I think the Buddha's energy, his determination to find his own solution to a spiritual crisis, a crisis similar to our own, and not necessarily just rely slavishly on old authorities or authority figures, but to branch out, find something fresh, that again is appealing to the modern sensibility.
Karen Armstrong, as a scholar of the religions of the world, you go to mosques and synagogues and churches. I'm wondering what aspects of Buddhism you've most incorporated into your life.
I know. My sister's a Buddhist and has been a Buddhist for 30 years, so Buddhism is in the family. But I know that I would be hopeless at yoga. I tried meditation for years in my convent, and I really flunked at it. It's not my thing. But I think what I've taken on board from Buddha is the importance of compassion. The Buddha said that compassion, which demands a divestment of selfishness, will lead you to the enlightenment that is the goal of the spiritual life. And I've come to be absolutely certain that he's right. Other religions teach that too. But I think the Buddha's emphasis on this and the utter humanity and kindness of his own bearing towards other people has been an inspiration for me. And I suppose that's how I'm going forward at the moment, concentrating on that, as it were, compassionate offensive.
Oh, one last question. You said you flunked at meditation. Meditation in the way that I understand it has a lot to do with silencing the mind and silencing the chatter of the mind. Being the intellectual that you are and the scholar that you are and the repository of history that you are, do you find it hard to silence that mind? Because that mind is, you know, perhaps your greatest gift.
I know. I think, yes, and I think now I've evolved a form of prayer, which I believe is rather Jewish, which is through study. And while I'm studying and engrossed in grappling with texts and history, sacred history very often, I will get moments of transcendence and awe and wonder, which my rabbinical colleagues tell me is what they do when they experience when they study Talmud or Torah. So that's the kind of meditation that I can do. I wasn't good at silencing my mind in that way, and largely the kind of methods of meditation I was teaching, was being taught as a young girl, was not right for me. And I think the Buddha, again, would say here, you've got to find a form of spirituality, a form of yoga that's absolutely right for you and not just do what everyone else is doing. So a bit of both. I think it left me, my whole failure with meditation, with such a sense of weariness and failure that the thought of sitting silently now fills me with a kind of dread.
Well, Karen Armstrong, I thank you so much for talking with us about the Buddha.
Thank you.
Karen Armstrong spoke recently with Terry Gross. Her new biography is Buddha. Coming up, the music of blues guitarist Reverend Gary Davis. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The folk revival of the early 60s boosted the careers of many forgotten blues performers. Most of these rediscovered blues guitarists played the eerie, introspective Mississippi Delta-style blues. But one of the most popular figures on the folk festival circuit was the blind Reverend Gary Davis, who fingerpicked in the ragtime-based Piedmont style. A new 3-CD anthology of Davis's work, called Demons and Angels, is now available. Music critic Milo Miles explains why Reverend Davis's pickin' keeps guitarists coming back for more.
Give us that buck, Dan.
Oh, boy. Is he here where you kick out fire?
From the time Gary Davis was 15 years old in 1911 until he was taken up by the coffeehouse crowd in the late 1950s, he played for money on the street. To keep at such a job for so long, you have to be driven and dedicated. To survive doing it, you have to be mighty good. The Reverend Gary Davis was all that. But unlike most blues obsessives, Davis burned with holy fire. He would read his Braille Bible through the night, preach as much as he played on the sidewalk, talk about being prepared to die until people made him stop. But the tunes from his voice and guitar would compel any heathen to sit through a sermon or two. Reverend Davis did supplement his income as a street musician by teaching guitar, especially after he moved to Harlem in 1944. He recorded the overwhelming majority of his records in his 60s and 70s after he was rediscovered. Around the same time, he began to pick up some pretty famous students: Bob Dylan, Ry Cooder, Jerry Garcia, Taj Mahal, and Jorma Kaukonen all took lessons from Davis. Supposedly, he always said, "You got the money, baby?" before he began. But it was only $5 for a session that might last all afternoon, with maybe a quick sermon thrown in.
Now I'm going to play a piano a little bit. Y'all would like to hear a piano? I've been picking a guitar a long time, but I'm going to play piano now.
Reverend Davis's deft, inventive fingerpicking in many styles and keys put him in an elite circle of blues guitar masters that includes Blind Blake, Blind Willie McTell, and Lonnie Johnson. In the number we just heard, Reverend Davis explicitly underscored the influence of ragtime piano on his playing. But it was more than a matter of notes and rhythms. He radiated the majestic ease of a ragtime virtuoso, precise and surprising in all tempos. He could vary the mood of a religious tune from stern to frightened to almost joyous, so his numerous re-recordings are more fascinating than average blues remakes. Perhaps Gary Davis's most important student was a superb guitarist, Stephan Grossman, who has done more to preserve his teacher's legacy than anyone. Grossman assembled the anthology called Demons and Angels, The Ultimate Collection, though the title is misleading because it's not a be-all and end-all. Newcomers should try a couple other albums. The first is Complete Early Recordings, which dates from the 30s and 40s, before cigars and singing over New York traffic roughened his voice. Another is Harlem Street Singer from 1960, which includes a roaring version of his signature tune, Samson and Delilah, and my favorite, Death Don't Have No Mercy.
Death don't have no mercy in this land. Death don't have no mercy in this land. He'll come to your house and he won't stay long. You look in the bed and somebody be gone. Death don't have no mercy in this land. Well,
death will go in any family.
For confirmed Davis fans, Demons and Angels is his most diverse collection ever and includes several definitive treatments and rare numbers. And yes, it has quite a few of his off-color secular blues, which he was reluctant to perform but obviously enjoyed once he got going. There's even his own kind of gangsta number, She Wouldn't Say Quit. So the information and entertainment is there with Demons and Angels. You just have to ask yourself, you got the money, baby?
Milo Miles is a music writer based in Cambridge. He reviewed Demons and Angels, a new collection of the music of Reverend Gary Davis.
He said, talk about the sun of our life, not the meridian sun that shines by day.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Well, the sun is going down. Well, the sun is going down. Well, the sun is going down. Oh, sun is go. Yeah, better find out where to go. Oh, better find out where to go. Oh, boy, still find out where to go. Hey, your house is burning down. Get somewhere and pray. You better get somewhere and pray. You better get somewhere and pray. And your time going in. And your time is going in. And your time is going in. Oh, send your time. Get rid of your sin. You better get rid of your sin. You better get rid of your sin. Oh, listen, get rid of your sin.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated Style Press Division, publisher of Mary and O'Neill, a novel and stories by debut author Justin Cronin. And from Saab, designing cars with the philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at SaabUSA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Merchants of Cool. We talk with media analyst Douglas Rushkoff about the multi-billion dollar marketing industry aimed at teenagers. It's the subject of a new Frontline documentary. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.